Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the FCC. We're very lucky today to have, well, he says he can't sum himself up in a sentence, but I think the man who headed up the Central Policy Unit for the decade up to 97 will have plenty of things to say on almost anything, financial, economic, banking, you name it. Leo Goodstadt can talk about it. So lots of questions, please, after this. First of all, we have a bit of housekeeping. On the 12th of May, we have a lunch for a Norwegian speaker, Felix, I can't pronounce this, but it's Tschudi, I think, talking about the opening up of the Northern Passage for shipping as a genuine alternative to piracy, which I think will be obviously have wider implications beyond just the shipping industry. Anyway, back to Leo, who tells us that next year will be his 50th anniversary of first coming to Hong Kong as a graduate student. So, nothing much more to say, really, except he's written a book, which I hope you'll all get signed. The book is called Reluctant Regulators, How the West Created and China Survived the Global Financial Crisis. Over to you, Leo.
That's a very daunting introduction, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to live up to it. But let me just start by saying something about this book that you've so kindly come to hear me introduce this afternoon. I'm truly impressed to see so many friends, I won't call them old friends, having just been called almost senile. You know, if I call you old friends, then you're on the edge of the graves. But it really is nice to have this opportunity to see so many friends and to be in such a warm and welcoming forum to introduce my book to Hong Kong. And it is a book written for Hong Kong and in many ways about Hong Kong. It has three messages. The first message is very simple. Washington and London knew that the banks and financial markets had serious, serious problems before 2007. So the crisis was predictable, and therefore, by implication, it was avoidable. The second message is that China has its own financial problems, and they're quite serious and daunting. But China can tolerate these in the banking sector because it has Hong Kong. When it interfaces with the outside world, which is what China has done so well for the last 30 years, Hong Kong is one of the world's best international financial centers, and Beijing can rely on Hong Kong to deliver. The third message is something surprising. I normally don't praise officials, normally don't praise governments, but this book actually says that when it comes to financial regulation and financial market supervision, Hong Kong has a record of excellence, which was first tested in the Asian financial crisis of 1997-98, and has been even more remarkably endorsed by the way Hong Kong came through the international financial crisis, which began in 2007. And the message from Hong Kong on this subject is that tough regulation brings financial stability, but it doesn't stop the growth of a rich and prosperous market. Another thing I have to say about the book is it's a journalist book. I mean, you know, it's not full of clever theories or new ideas. I just went and looked at what regulators said about themselves, not even what the newspapers reported, what they said about themselves, and wrote it down. And it's, you know, for a journalist, nothing could be more lucky. These guys make self-criticisms. They were making them beginning from around 1998 about what was going wrong. And for those of you old enough to remember the Red Guards and the Cultural Revolution, it's just like reading people denouncing their records and how they've gone wrong, but these guys remain in office. So the book is based on what officials say about their own performance, to some extent supplemented by what people like the IMF and the World Bank said. So to come to, you know, the message, the first message, the flyer told you that after the worst losses in history, the world's banks have bounced back. So let me throw some figures at you to show that this is no dead cat bounce. Citigroup, according to the OECD, probably had the highest banking losses in the global crisis. The US Fed rescued Citibank with a $45 billion US dollar investment. The investment has been recovered, and in addition, the United States government made $12 billion in profit on that rescue operation. Then AIG was the second biggest loser in the international financial crisis, according to the OECD. The American government rescued it with $100 billion, and all the signs are that the American government will get all its money back, plus a profit. If you look at the financial markets themselves, the world's biggest, New York, the securities industry of New York in 2009 made $61 billion profit. That was the largest it had ever made in history, and it was three times the profits made in 2006. So the financial markets have really had robust recovery. And this is very encouraging in a way, because it tells us financial markets did what they were supposed to do, that whether times are good or times are bad, they're able to make a market. And the banks themselves, albeit with generous government help, also for the most part survived and have bounced back, have found new ways to make profits, even in the aftermath of the world's worst financial crisis in probably a century. So the message is very encouraging, isn't it? And we do have people, though, who argue that the price of saving the banks and the financial markets will be excessive. And quite a lot of people who are in the business media got very worried in 2008 about the American government's TARP program, $700 billion spent on rescuing the American economy from the financial crisis. But again, you know, the critics have been confounded. The pessimists have been proved wrong. By late last year, all $700 billion had been recovered. And we're now in QE2, and people are saying QE2 is going to destroy the stability of the world financial system. But it doesn't look as if that's what's going to happen. I mean, the critics may be right, but the chances are quite high that QE2 will prove to have worked its magic, so to speak, in providing stability and opportunities from growth. And where the American government has made investments, it'll get them back, and we'll get them back with a profit. So the obvious question is, can we all relax, buy bank shares, and look forward to a very happy retirement? Well, I wouldn't be here speaking about this issue if the answer was as simple as that. Because the global financial crisis proved both affordable and manageable, the pressure to reform or to improve performance has started to slacken. You know, what's broke? So, for example, the Bank of England has done a calculation which suggests that the total banking losses in the United States and the United Kingdom are roughly equal to 1% of GDP. Well, that's quite a lot of money. But as the Bank of England says, this is an affordable sum which you can even recover from the banks themselves. So why should we get too excited? Free markets went into chaos, and the systems actually, in a sense, worked because they didn't bust and they've come back to profitability. And yes, you know, I go along with that in a certain way. But the trouble is this. What happened before 2007 was that so many problems were foreseen, so many breakdowns, so many malfunctions by people like the insurance industry, by the ratings industry, by people creating derivatives based on property. Now, these were weaknesses in the market which had been identified. Those weaknesses have led to catastrophic losses by ordinary men and women, by businesses across all European, UK, US, the whole of their economies. So, yes, the banks are fine, but the price that's been paid for the downturn in business is spread across the whole of Western society. So when you say that, you now put it into context. These are losses which are so painful. For people over 50, it's almost impossible for them to recover from. So they're so painful. The fact that the banks have recovered profitability is no comfort. So we go back again and say, are the banks safe? Yeah, they're safe in the sense that they're not going to fall, they will bounce back. But what we have to think about now is how to make sure that this kind of event, which causes catastrophic consequences for most people in society, for a large range of business, how do we prevent this happening again? And the answer is, we don't actually need a new system. We have the laws in place, we have the policies in place, we have the systems in place that, had they been enforced before 2007, would have prevented this kind of disaster. And, you know, this is not me passing a verdict on these guys. They say it themselves. People like Bernanke in the United States, people like King in England, and their deputies admit, confess up front that they got things wrong, and they give details. And you go back and you can see people making specific decisions, 2002, 2003, 2005, 2006, failing to act and saying, no, no, we'll leave it to the market. And that's the point. People believed in the market. They believe that markets are naturally wise, naturally virtuous, naturally self-regulating. They were convinced that if you intervene in the market, officials are bound to cause inefficiency, waste. They don't understand business. Keep them away from the market. Let the markets police themselves. And in particular, it became an article of faith that the markets will signal to shareholders of banks and financial institutions when things are going wrong. The share price will fall. The trouble with this is, of course, that, I mean, A, banking is not about shareholders. The trouble with banking is they don't just use shareholders' money, they use depositors' money. And the depositors are everybody in society. I don't care about the shareholders. Nobody cares about the shareholders. What we care about is what happens to depositors when banks close. That's what counts. But the share prices did not signal weak banks. And there's a huge study done of this. There's a study of 165 banks who have more than $50 billion in assets, and another 386 banks with more than $10 billion in assets. So this is a major survey. And what they found was that the share price in 2006 was a very good guide to which were the weak banks. Those whose share prices were most buoyant were going to do worse when the crisis came. So, you know, the market signals were going the wrong way. So the regulators, particularly Bernanke, but not just Bernanke, most regulators, almost all economists, most political leaders said, the market is so efficient compared with officials, leave it to the market. Even when we know they're breaking the rules, let the market sort that out. Now, the trouble that follows from this is this, that again, in a way, these officials, these academics, these political leaders were not stupid. They'd had 30 years by 2007 of what's described as the fastest escape from poverty from most parts of the world, but particularly Asia, that we can find in history. And there was a clear link between the retreat from state planning, the retreat from state controls, the retreat from excessive regulation. There's a clear, clear link. But the link was a kind of misleading one, because in countries like India or China, the kind of planning they had before was Marxist, and it was total, and it wasn't about economic, market-driven, efficiency-driven goals. And this kind of planning was found in many places. In the United States and the United Kingdom, the regulation they had, particularly in the United Kingdom, which became a pace setter in deregulation of financial markets, the United Kingdom had some of the most extensive controls on financial services in the world at the end of the Second World War, and they took a long time to dismantle. They didn't dismantle exchange controls till 1979, for example. So, yes, they were decontrols, but they were decontrols to do with events of the past, not with the environment of the present. So at this point, you know, it's important to bring Hong Kong into the picture. So what does Hong Kong tell us? Hong Kong tells us this. We have here an economy which escaped the worst pain of the Asian financial crisis. Yes, our property market collapsed. By 2003, property prices, the residential property prices, had dropped 70%. But look at the defaults on mortgages. You know, they're trivial, except for those who were hit by them, but it's, you know, less than 2.5%, even at the worst. You know, 70% fall in the market values, negative equity, you know, fantastic, and less than 2.5% default on mortgages. Now, how is this? No banking crisis, despite this fall in property values. And the answer is because we had regulation. And the regulation starts by saying, we just simply don't trust bankers to get it right. And this is even more the case following 2007. Not only didn't we have any sort of collapse of the property market or the share market, you know, the monetary authority is saying, hey, we're going to give in limited guarantees of this and that. And everybody knows they're not needed. And when AIG went bust and its subsidiary in Hong Kong, AIA, came under pressure and people started to cash in their policies, the government just announced, by the way, they said, AIA can't transfer any of its money to its parent in AIG. It's got to stay here for Hong Kong policyholders. And that run was over. I mean, you know, this is a quality of regulation and supervision which is astounding. Now, if anybody wishes to challenge the excellence of Hong Kong as an international financial center, I have the figures with me, which I'll throw at you. But let's just take it for granted that we have an IFC that is really, really good. So it's grown, and it's grown in many ways. It first grew, as far as we're concerned, our generation, in the Cold War. We provided the alternative for China to the outside world, to hard currency, when the United States was maintaining a total embargo up to 71. And then up till the 80s, 81, 82, still the way to the outside world, because there were these legal claims against the Chinese government by bondholders in the United States who were seizing Chinese-owned cargo, Chinese-owned cargo ships, and Chinese-owned assets. So Hong Kong played this role. And then China opens up in 78, and then what does Hong Kong do? Provides more than half the FDI that China wants. And then it wants to come to the market. It has these IPOs. And what does Hong Kong do then? The biggest IPOs in the world are run through Hong Kong. And, you know, Hong Kong doesn't even notice it. It just goes through the system. So Hong Kong has this excellence. So how is it able to do this? How is it able to innovate, develop, grow, and so on, when the regulation is actually getting stricter and stricter? This is another kind of conjuring trick, but it's a fact. Competition too, openness to foreign banks improved at the same time that the monetary authority is tightening up its restrictions in the current century. So Hong Kong is proof that good regulation, tough regulation, is not hostile to market growth, innovation, profitability, whatever else you like to think. Why did Hong Kong do this? It isn't because Hong Kong is a place which likes interfering with business affairs. On the contrary, we could almost say, couldn't we, that in some areas the government doesn't interfere enough, but that's another story. So they did it because they had no choice. And one of the most interesting things about the 2007-2009 financial crisis is this. The problems that plagued London and Washington, or London and New York, are reruns of exactly the same frauds, bubbles, overlending to property, and all the rest of it, which Hong Kong had up till 1986. Every 10 years, from the 30s till 1985, Hong Kong was plagued by bank runs, financial scandals, and all the rest of it. And then in 1986, the government found it had become politically too expensive to continue not to regulate. At that point, they have a new law, new system, and they get tough. Simply, we don't trust bankers anymore. The government didn't really want to do that, but the public said we won't go on bailing them out. So now let's just turn to China. Now, China is a very interesting case because China has serious problems, most of which are kind of brushed aside in this miracle growth that the country has achieved. And why not? If you have 10% growth sustained year after year since 1978, you know, sort of small problems like the banking sector's bad loans and all the rest of it don't seem to be too important. But the Chinese government itself takes a different view. So the People's Bank of China, the Central Bank of China, said in 2005 that there were many banks in the country whose loan default records are so dreadful, I'm quoting now, that head offices ought to withdraw their freedom to do more than one or two loan transactions a year. It's as bad as that. And then in 2009, the IMF did a survey, and it said that the correlation between efficiency and profitability in Chinese banks is close to zero. I mean, you know. So the Chinese government has this difficulty, which up till now it hasn't had to worry too much about. And hasn't had to worry too much about because if growth is driven by exports, and those exports and their needs in terms of whatever it may be, capital, foreign exchange transactions and all the rest of it, if they can be handled by the branches of mainland banks in Hong Kong as well as Hong Kong's own banks, why do you worry? You know, this is the place that specializes in excellence. Get on with it. In Anhui, in Yunnan province, if it's not going so well, it doesn't matter. On the international relationship side, it's taken care of. So you can make a strong case for saying that Hong Kong has helped the Chinese government to schedule, to timetable its banking reforms at its own convenience. It's about to change. And it's about to change for a strange reason, that the quality of life has become a major theme of China's economic planning. This is the 12th five-year plan, has this sustainability and quality life as sort of its benchmarks. And you then hit problems, you see, because you want to boost housing. You want to give people better homes. So when you try to do that, it means you've got to find land. And the main source of land is local governments, and they're delighted because they're short of resources. Their tax base, local government tax base in China, is among the smallest, the tightest in the world. So property is the way for them to finance future development. But when you have this kind of situation, the danger of bubble markets is very high indeed. And since when the financial crisis broke, the Chinese government was most anxious that local governments should bear the brunt of maintaining the economic momentum. And that led to land transactions, pushing of land sales, property market up, which is now the property bubble that the Chinese government worries about so much today. But there's another side to it as well. You say quality of life. And one of the things about quality of life in China that the officials at the top worry about is the motor car, the automobile. And they've been saying for a number of years that China has too many automobiles and they cause environmental pollution and it's going to become unattractive and there should be no further expansion. The industry itself says that they're desperately short of capacity. Pressure is being put on the banks to stop lending to the motor car, to the automobile industry. But the demand from the market is something else. The government says the bank should restrict lending. The market says you should lend to the automobile industry. So you've now got this conflict which the Chinese government is going to have to solve. And it's work in progress. I'd like to just end now by saying something about the China-Hong Kong, the mainland-Hong Kong relationship. I guess if I asked people to put up their hands and say how many of you thought that Hong Kong will be overtaken by Shanghai in 2, 5, 10 years, most hands would go up. So I keep, you know, my hair's fallen out waiting for Shanghai to catch up with us. It was promised before the Cultural Revolution started. It was announced during the Cultural Revolution. You know, it goes on and on and on. So the nice thing about China and having being under the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party Central Committee is that what the leadership says tends to have a kind of authority to it. And there's a kind of monotonous authority to it when it comes to Hong Kong. Zhu Rongji, Prime Minister before the current incumbent, 2002, he said, Hong Kong is a shining pearl of China and plays a unique, irreplaceable role in China's modernization drive. Irreplaceable. Okay, this irreplaceable became irreplaceable in speeches about Hong Kong. Wen Jiabao, in April of 2009, you know, when the world financial crisis was still quite a serious thing, he said, expressing boredom, "I have said years ago that Hong Kong's status as an international financial center is irreplaceable." And then he goes into the usual boring details about our efficiency, rule of law, and all the rest of it. And then he gets even more tired in March this year at the National People's Congress at his question and answer after that. He was asked again about Hong Kong. So he says, "Hong Kong's advantaged position as an international financial center has not changed. Is nobody listening out there?" And then he went on to add, "Hong Kong is developing itself into an offshore RMB settlement center, an international assets managed center, for which the central government gives its full support." It sounds like Hong Kong is still going to be in business, serving the mainland's needs for a long time to come. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Leo. Now we'll take 15 minutes of questions. Can you please put your hand up and identify yourself, and we can pass around microphones. Tom Holland, where are you?
Hello, Leo. Tom Holland from the South China Morning Post. You wondered if anyone would challenge Hong Kong's reputation for excellence in financial regulation, so I shall. Your focus has been very much on the preservation of systemic stability. That's only one part of financial regulation. You have barely mentioned investor protection. In fact, the Lehman mini bonds rate just one mention in your book. And it is a fact that when we look at regulation in Hong Kong, if you look at the Monetary Authority, for example, nowhere in its mandate is investor protection is mentioned. The Monetary Authority is not interested in looking after ordinary people. It wasn't interested in stopping the banks selling toxic trash to their depositors. They've now been bailed out, but the banks continue to peddle toxic trash in the form of shares, where the prospectuses are works of complete fiction, where the auditors have no credibility at all, and where the financial statements made about the securities that the banks sell have simply no credibility. And what that lack of credibility has created is, in effect, a casino. If the financial statements concerning the securities are not believable, then all you create is an enormous casino. This isn't a financial center, this is a casino. How would you respond to that?
Well, I have to say, first of all, thank you to Tom Holland for having read the book. Secondly, of course, I share your sentiments entirely. Thirdly, it is true I only mention Lehman mini bonds once in the book. I do actually have a section which says, which makes a plea for the protection of the investor in what I think are the most compelling terms. It points out that if we look at other industries like pharmaceuticals, the need for protection of the investor, even though the industry is people who get treated with pharmaceuticals are treated by qualified medical personnel and so on. And I say the analogy is perfectly clear. So in the case of Hong Kong, the most important rule for me is not systemic stability, it's the enforcement of law and the avoidance of fraud. And in the banking system, that's been the case. And how do we know that this has been the case? And the answer is because we have the Lehman mini bonds as the one scandal that's affected us as a result of the 2007-2009 financial crisis. And this is a kind of truth test that these people were missold. There no denial about the fact that they have lost money and that they need to be looked after. An effort has been made to get the banks to pay compensation to them, and so that they don't have to go through all the endless litigation. That has been a long and protracted issue. There have been some cases which have gone to court. A criminal case, which when you first read the reports in your own newspaper about it, you were sure the executive involved would definitely be found guilty. And the judge's remarks at the end of the case, when found in favor of the accused, were quite devastating, you know. So there are difficulties in bringing criminal prosecutions. So, you know, I have to say that consumer protection is very, very important. It's important in my book. It's important to Hong Kong people. And banking stability is the first port of call for protecting the public. If they lose their deposits, they've lost everything. And then enforcement of due diligence, of excellent standards of corporate governance. Enforce the law as we have it. I mean, you've just said it. The prospectuses, if they're misleading, people should go to prison. If the auditor's reports are not full and accurate, people should be charged against their professional bodies. The government should intervene, and if necessary, criminal charges. I have no quarrel at all with the sentiments that you've expressed. And I just apologize that my sub-editor, you know, didn't give, you know, higher prominence to the sentiments that I share with you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Over here.
You said just now that you were in, Robin Fox, I'm an associate. You said just now you were in a complete agreement with the sentiments expressed by the previous questioner. So would you like to give us some examples where documents of complete works of fiction have in fact been published, approved by the regulators?
No, I'm not. I'm sorry. Just. Could I just have that again? Are you asking me, do I know of any cases where they've been published?
I mean, it strikes me that the previous.
Well, I'm saying if they have been published, then they should be prosecuted.
Okay. Anybody else?
Hi, Tara Joseph Hoy with Thomson Reuters. You mentioned the shining pearl of Hong Kong continues to be a great financial center that works well with China. But you also mentioned in the beginning of your talk about some of the dangers that is within the Chinese banking system at the moment. If we do see a major fallout in China's banking system, can Hong Kong really withstand that given the increased ties and cooperation?
Well, you know, the whole history of Hong Kong's relationship with China over the last 60 years has Hong Kong withstanding huge traumas suffered by the Chinese economy and its financial system. I mean, the list is enormous. There was the complete nationalization of all foreign trade and all banks in China, 49, 50, 51. There was the Korean War when we lost our entire markets in China. And then you had the Great Leap Forward, followed by 3 years of famine when the supplies of food and other substances and other necessities to Hong Kong were affected and the Chinese government had to make special arrangements. You got the Cultural Revolution when Red Guards were saying in Beijing you can't accept travelers' checks which are issued by Hong Kong, by American banks in Hong Kong, even if they're in sterling, because we're going to oppose American imperialism. You got the shock to the system of China and the challenge to Hong Kong of the opening up of China when we moved all our manufacturing capacity into Guangdong province. I mean, we've survived all these, and the return to Chinese sovereignty, I mean, in most places would have shaken confidence permanently. But we survived all those. I don't see why a new shakeout at a major Chinese bank would cause us that much trouble.
Anybody else? Okay, we've heard.
Richard Cullen from Hong Kong University. Leo, I'm wondering, if there'd been no global financial crisis, would you have still been able to write a book? And what would the theme of the book be then? Thank you.
Well, you know, this is a terrible question. No, because this is a journalist book. If there's no bad news, why am I writing a book? And you'll notice that people here are saying, hey, how have you got good news about Hong Kong? We don't want to hear it. The answer is no. You know, and, you know, I promise I will never, ever have a section in a book which has good news for the future. There's no story in good news. But what I will say about this, you know, which is a serious comment, that we who are involved in analysis, whether as academics or as journalists or as people making business decisions, our failure to recognize that the financial services sector in particular has to put on the table the truth about what is happening, our failure to see that, to read what these guys were saying, to listen carefully to what they were saying, to lobby against them when they were making decisions that were going to be plainly wrong. I mean, we're culpable. And one of the things I hope for the future, I hope that my book will encourage, is people to actually watch what these officials say and what political leaders say, because it's a question of, you know, it's a question of our financial fate. So when you've got statements being made about how dangerous it was to have AIG type relations with the banking system, I mean, said by the Bank of England and by the Fed, and the decision being publicized, we're not going to do anything about it, because if we intervened, it would mean that the creation of more financial products might be impeded. And you're just admitting that these financial products are dangerous. I mean, somebody should have screamed. I should have screamed at the time, but I didn't. So, yeah, I mean, everything had gone on, I suppose I'd have been the same, you know, half-asleep guy that I was beforehand. But you know, I hope I won't miss anything in future.
Okay. Anybody else over here?
Nigel Benesley-Blank, Roma. Leo, I haven't read the book yet, but I promise to. What is your position on the splitting up of the bank's roles between investment and retail banking, and possible re-imposition of the Glass-Steagall Act? And regardless of your position, what are the chances of that happening?
Well, you know, again, one of the nice things about a journalist, if he's got any sense, I don't have any opinions. News is shocking, views is not. So, but to be more serious, the Glass-Steagall Act worked in many ways. I mean, it preserved the American banking system from a great deal of trouble. The question is whether you can go back to it, and the IMF has written some quite frank reports in the last year about what's happening on the reform front, and they point out there's this dilemma. If you start to reform in this way, major reforms, then the growth rate of the financial service industry is going to slow seriously. And as it happens, as a matter of fact, the financial service industry's growth rates in both the United States and the United Kingdom have been far higher over the last several decades than any other sector in the economy. So when you make a decision you're going to do something which slows down the growth rate, then there's going to be huge opposition throughout the whole business community. On top of that, no politician is going to take responsibility for a measure which quite quickly will be perceived as having, you know, gone back to vanilla flavour, dull, boring, unprofitable. And this will apply to people who are trying to rebuild their pensions and all the rest of it by making new investments on their own behalf or institutionally. So the chances of this happening are quite small. I think it's a serious issue that ought to be considered, because I believe that financial stability is absolutely vital for an economy. But I'm afraid the temptation not to do it will be very strong.
I think that's all we have time for today. So thank you very much, Leo. Just remains me to give you the FCC present.